Right, well, earlier we heard Sister Unity's choice of track, Pull Up to the Bumper. Grace Jones, who's startled to find out, was 75 years old. And as we heard herself say, look, first and foremost, it's just a fun track. And fair enough, music being fun, one of the main points about it in the first place, I'd say, and that's obviously not a complicated idea. But music is, of course, much more than just for fun, and the effect that it has on us all, well, that's much more complicated. But my next guest, Samuel Meir, has made that his life's work at the moment. He's recently arrived in Tamaki Makaurau to join the Music Lab, which is an international research operation that zeroes in on just how people respond to music, and that's people all over the world. There's a link to the lab, by the way, on our webpage if you want to have a look at that. That's rnz.co.nz/Sunday. And Samuel's with us now. Kia ora, talofa, Samuel.
Kia ora, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, no problem. It's great that you're here. Pull Up to the Bumper, we heard earlier, was the choice of Sister Unity. Grace Jones says just about parallel parking a limousine, right? No sort of other.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Can't imagine it's about anything else.
No, fair enough. Too. But I was thinking, you're from the States, aren't you?
Yeah, I grew up in Boston.
So wouldn't it be Pull Up to the Fender? They don't have bumpers in the US.
We use both words in the Boston area.
Interchangeable. All right, I wasn't aware of that. Now, can you explain for us the Music Lab? What exactly is the nature of this international network? Because from what I can gather, some of these research projects you do take in, you know, the responses of hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, so we're a research lab based in the School of Psychology here at the University of Auckland, but we also have a sister site at the Yale Child Study Center in New Haven, Connecticut in the States. And our research uses one set of methods that are typically called citizen science methods. So at themusiclab.org, we have a whole bunch of different experiments online that take the form of quick games that are quite fun for participants. And because they're fun and because they give participants information about themselves, their scores, their musical abilities, people tend to do them and then get their friends to do them. And this has a follow-on effect. So we end up running many, many people in our experiments, and we just passed our 5 millionth experiment run on the website.
Oh, okay. So is the goal then to get kind of truly, well, as cross-cultural as you can, people right across different continents, ages, so, and it need not be something like, you know, a tremendously popular song or tune, it's styles of music, and to get as many people around the world to respond as possible, to find a pattern.
That's right. So one of the big motivations for this comes from a big issue in psychological science these days, which is usually called the reproducibility crisis. We have a lot of trouble in psychology in that a lot of our major findings come from brick-and-mortar laboratories where, you know, you're working in a city someplace, typically in a city, and you only study the people who happen to be able to show up to your lab and do the experiments that you've got physically there. So the internet has been a pretty incredible solution to this problem, or part of the way towards a solution to this problem, because when you make an experiment that is gamified and that is fun for participants to do, they participate in a naturalistic way in their home or on their phone, wherever they happen to be, and they tend to do it in really large numbers. And because they do it in really large numbers, it lets you do the sorts of analyses that you can't do in a brick-and-mortar laboratory. So, for example, in a paper that recently came out by one of my graduate students, Jing Liu, and a postdoc, Courtney Hilton, who's here in Auckland, we were looking at the differences in music processing abilities across people who had different native languages.
So when you say music processing, do you mean people listen to the music and you gauge how they're responding, like literally the psychology, what's
exactly? So how they understand the vibrating air that's making it into their auditory cortex, how they take the mess of sound that they're hearing and break it down into structured information. So basically, the psychological problem of understanding music when you hear, you know, the song your previous guest was talking about, is you got to figure out what's in it.
So give us an example though of where you've done that. You've taken some form of music and sound, played it to a wide range of people around the world to find a pattern.
So in the study that Jing and Courtney just published, for example, one of the music processing tasks that they do is they study the ability for listeners to hear whether a beat is appropriately synchronized with the music that's going on. So they'll hear a piece of music where the beat, click track, has been altered or not altered to be just synced up with the beat of the actual song or not. And what we find when we play this, do this sort of task with many different listeners is that the native language of the listener is predictive of whether they're particularly good or not at this task. So people who speak tonal languages like Mandarin Chinese or, for example, Yoruba, an African language, they tend to have a little bit of a disadvantage at this sort of beat synchronization ability. So a lot of the experiments that we run on the site are focusing in on these fairly fine-grained musical tasks in the same way that if we were studying, for example, language, you might have different language abilities. You might be able to more quickly think of synonyms for a word, or you might be able to remember lists of words longer than other people. Everybody varies in terms of their music processing abilities. And one of the big goals of the site is to try and capture some of that diversity worldwide.
So if you speak a tonal language, you're more likely to interpret that music that you mentioned there, where there was a beat or an offbeat. So are there some people that, if they're not speaking the tonal language, are much less likely to pick that up, or more likely?
Well, we see a lot of diversity across listeners on that kind of task. In that same study, we had a couple of other music processing tasks, things like remembering melodies, whether you hear a difference in a melody, if it's been altered by a tone, hearing mistuning in voices. And the kind of big picture finding from that study is not that like a particular person is really good at this task and another particular person is really bad, but rather that your experience as a person in the world, the language that you happen to grow up speaking, which of course you don't get to choose. You're born into the world and you learn the language that's being spoken around you, or the languages that are spoken around you. That experience of the world has a profound effect on how you hear the world as a grown person, right? And in fact, we also have children doing these studies as well. A big focus of our lab is developmental psychology, studying infants and children. And we've run experiments, gamified experiments on our site that are targeted for kids. We had a paper that also Courtney Hilton, the postdoc I mentioned here in Auckland, led with an honors student, Liam Crowley Detiri. And there we were looking at how children interpret songs from many different places. So when they hear a lullaby from a foreign culture, despite the fact that they don't know much about that culture, they don't recognize the language, they're able to identify that song, oh yeah, that would be good for calming a baby down.
Mm. Well, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, the lullabies, because we have put together a kind of minute-long mashup of some of the lullabies that you used in this music lab experiment. Can I call it an experiment? It sounds awfully scientific.
I would say it's a collection of experiments. So the musiclab.org is a citizen science platform that we use to run lots and lots of different research projects.
Okay. So we have this minute-long mashup here. I'll just explain to people what they're about to hear. So the first part is a lullaby from it's the Sami people, Scandinavia, in the north there. The second, Nahua people in the Maya area of Mexico. The third from Kuna people of Central America. And the fourth is an excerpt from a lullaby from Highland Scots in the UK. Here it is.
Pani mati dora bibi toke kuhoya. Pani hua bibi toe di pani kudoe. Ukare nyokto kupa. Ha pa pa piya, ha pa 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 piya. Ha pa pa piya kukiya. Ha pa 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 piya kukiya. Ha ta ta pishungma. Ai hin ye yamu. Betrothed in a bartok and Christian in a pilgrim, peacekeeper Joe.
Wow, there we go. So four different lullabies there from around the world. So what do you learn from playing that to all these people in far-flung places around the world?
This is a bit of a throwback because I haven't heard these lullabies in quite a while. In fact, we built a corpus of music from many different societies when I was a graduate student. This is a number of years ago now, and we've still been using a lot of these songs because they are a nice way to sample music from lots and lots of different cultures. So another problem, before I mentioned the reproducibility crisis in psychology, another problem in psychology is the generalizability crisis.
What does that mean?
What that means is in psychology, psychology, there's a big problem in how we're able to generalize findings from one lab experiment to our species as a whole. You would hope that as psychologists, we were interested in human minds, not just the minds of people here in Auckland or people in the States or wherever. We want to know about all humans. And one roadblock to doing that is that the materials that we study in our psychological experiments tend to be biased. They tend to not be from representative samples of content from lots of places. So one of the ways that we're trying to get around that is we do things like we build corpora. A corpus is basically a big collection of stimuli, of content. And in our case, it's music. But if you were studying vision, you could be studying images from lots of places or films from lots of places. So in this set of lullabies that we've just heard, these are a few lullabies from a larger set of songs used in specific behavioral contexts. So lullabies are generally used to calm infants down or put a baby to sleep. But we also have other kinds of songs as well that we study, typically defined by the behaviors that happen with them in the cultures where they're recorded. So in a study using these songs, at the very basic level, one thing we were interested in a number of years ago was just what do people think of these songs? When they hear those lullabies, can they tell anything about their soothing qualities? I mean, it turns out that they can't. So if you've never heard those songs
across
before.
Across the cultures.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So they're sort of mutually understandable. And, you know, listeners would not have heard these four songs before just now. But if you were listening to them at home, you probably had a sense that they were kind of soothing. They might fit if you happen to know that song. You might want to use it to calm a baby down or put a baby to sleep.
I think parents across all cultures have a genuine interest in the short-term objective of calming a child down.
Well, exactly.
So they're immediately useful. But what about in terms of like actual long-term health studies studies that reach across this many people that have that huge sample size, does that make them more useful for actually working out what's even good for us long-term health-wise?
Well, I think we hope so. I think, you know, the first question is the more basic question is, do these songs have features in common with one another? Because if they do, that suggests that they might work in the same ways globally. And they do seem to have some features in common with one another. The lullabies are soothing in the same ways across different cultures. We've done some experiments where we bring babies into the lab and we play these foreign songs to them and find out that they, in fact, relax more. Their heart rates drop. Their electrodermal activity goes down. And because there seem to be some immediate impacts of lullabies in calming infants, that raises this bigger question of, you know, if families are using music to regulate their infants' emotions at home, then, you know, in the long run, that could have some nice benefits for them. If you're a parent with a really fussy baby and you've got a new tool to calm your baby down, you're going to be a happier parent.
Oh, yeah.
anyone who's ever met a baby knows that you know, one of the biggest priorities of having a baby around is making sure that they're okay and helping them to rest and to calm down when they're upset. Babies get upset for a lot of different reasons, many of them good reasons.
Although surely, logically, if these are very traditional songs – that we heard there, that would have been used over years and years. So the utility of them has already been worked out, right? Parents would have stopped singing those songs to their kids if it didn't calm them down.
Well, that's right. That's right. Exactly. So I mean, in some sense, this research program is blazingly obvious, but that doesn't mean it's not important to do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, a lot of parents in 2023 might not jump to singing to their infants as the first thing to do for their babies. They might grab their phone or buy a toy that's particularly nice for them or something because, you know, we're in a very content-rich environment. There's a lot of stuff you can do with your baby as a parent. Parents might not realize, oh, I know all these songs. I could just sing to them. Maybe I should give that a try. So one of the things that we're doing these days in the lab is testing that question exactly. So we have a new study that's run by an honor student here, Estelle Lai, where she's going to be recruiting parents and babies from the community, here in town, to give them some resources to help them to sing more with their babies. And in these studies, what we do is we provide a little smartphone tool where we can keep track of what happens as a result of this singing behavior. So we ask parents very simple questions, things like, last night, how much did your baby wake up? Did they wake up once? Did they wake up no times at all? Did they wake up a lot of times? We ask them questions like, you know, in the last half hour, you know, we'll send them a text message and say, in the last half hour, was your baby fussy? If so, what did you do to calm them down? Did it work? You know, these sorts of very basic questions about the day-to-day life of parents and infants turn out to have really important health impacts, but they're sort of difficult to study, and they haven't been studied that much in the context of music, which suggests to me that there's sort of an untapped opportunity here to help parents to deal with the sort of tricky problems associated with having a little human at home.
So you can pick out patterns or common themes, maybe from people who live really far apart in different environments, different language, all of that. But what about is in terms of individuals and how we respond to music and what it does to us? Recently, I chatted on RNZ to a guy called Tom Tebocht. He's a psychologist and professor of pop music at Utrecht University in Holland. He reckoned there were two periods in a person's life where music was really important: during adolescence and then when you're really, really old, maybe starting to lose it a bit, literally in terms of your dementia patients were responding to music in a really intense way that other people might not. And then your music taste was actually getting set at the other end between 14 and 22. And it seemed to me like that seemed extremely reductive, putting ages up, 14 to 22. How would you set your music taste then? It didn't seem likely. But he was quite convincing in the end. But does that sound like something that could be supported by a citizen science thing like yours, canvassing hundreds of thousands of people?
Yeah, so I mean, one really useful tool that we can, or one advantage to the citizen science tool, is that you can do these studies that look at a particular phenomenon across many different ages. So I don't know if, 14 is the right age or 12 is the right age. I mean, I think anyone would say adolescence is a period when people's identities are being formed, and music is a pretty key part of everyone's identity. Everyone has their strong musical preferences and will argue all night about whether their music is better or worse than some other thing. It's not necessarily about putting a specific date on it, but you could imagine doing a study where we're looking at, for example, preferences for one kind of music or another, and looking at how those change across the lifespan. There are a number of citizen science studies in psychology that ask similar questions about other domains.
That would be a seriously long-term piece of work, though, wouldn't it, if you followed people's music taste over years?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you could follow the same people as they grow up in their lives, or you could take a more what we call a cross-sectional approach, where you ask lots and lots of people of different ages the same sorts of questions, and you look at how different ages predict a particular phenomenon. So, for example, cognitive abilities, there's been citizen science studies that look at, where does the age of a particular ability, the skill at a particular ability peak in the lifespan. So, are 30-year-olds better at vocabulary than 20-year-olds, and so on. So you can give a vocabulary test if it's gamified enough and fun enough for lots of people to do, and get, a million people to do it on the internet, and then just plot, what do the scores look like at each age. So you could imagine doing some kind of study like that with musical preferences. We haven't done it yet. But one of the reasons I'm sort of excited about how our lab has built up this citizen science approach is that it opens up a lot of questions that you might not otherwise be able to study in traditional psychological environments.
It's interesting you use that term gamify, which to some people will seem like it's a bit of a trivialization. It's a serious research. It shouldn't be a game. However, we've had debates recently about the low level of completing the census, for example, and people saying, well, how can we persuade people this is worth doing? Because I guess filling it out is not a fun, it is a chore. However, people have pointed out that, when we had the Pokemon phenomenon, Pokemon Live, you had groups of people at weird hours of the night all gathering in certain places to catch a digital non-existent creature.
That's right.
That's a gamified thing. And people left their homes in the night to do this.
It turns out people really like to do things that are fun.
Which is earth-shattering.
We need a professional psychologist to say that. But, as somebody who's completed the census in three different countries, let me tell you that the New Zealand census is actually not so bad. If you've ever filled it out in the U.S., it's a real chore. And I think, it is a good point that there's a risk of looking at this sort of gamification idea and thinking it trivializes things. On the contrary, though, if you do something in a way that participants are going to enjoy, I think there's an aspect of that suggests they're going to be more likely to do it in a natural way. So, for example, if you really set up some kind of contrived situation, you've brought them into the lab to study some phenomenon and it's just very unnatural and weird, the behavior that you elicit from them in the lab may be weird itself. You might not really be observing human behavior, you're observing humans in the lab behavior.
Right.
So when you gamify an experiment and it's something that you do that, participants are doing because they heard about it from a friend or, saw a tweet about it or something, and it's just sort of a one-off fun thing for them to do and they don't even think about it, you may be getting a more accurate slice of human behavior than you would otherwise get. So I think, you know, I don't work for the census, but gamifying the census is not really that bad an idea. I mean, if it were more fun, more people would do it.
Yeah, well, people were horrified at the thought of, you know, tickets being given out to rugby league games and so on as an incentive, and saying, what's our country coming to if people have to be persuaded, you know, rewarded for doing mm-hmm. something that's a civic duty. However, yeah, like I say, when I saw those groups of people on the Wellington waterfront, freezing cold night, clutching their phones, looking for to capture this digital Pokemon, I'm thinking, yeah, there's got to be some way you could weaponize this.
Well, incentives are pretty wild, in terms of getting people to do things. And what we found on our music experiments, online, is that there are a lot of ways that you can get people to do these and really enjoy it. So, you know, telling people something about themselves they didn't know goes a really long way. Just giving people an image that they can show their friends. You know, in our case, often we at the end of an experiment, we give them a pretty graph of their performance. And they tweet it or they put it on Facebook or send it to their family. I've heard participants who have, 20 family members in their WhatsApp chat, and they're all sharing their graphs with each other to compete with one another. In some sense, it's a trick to boost recruitment for scientific research. But in another sense, it's getting citizens involved in the science in a useful way. You know, I used to live in Wellington, and everybody in Wellington has the GeoNet app on their phone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The shaking part of the GeoNet app is a gamified experiment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like one. You know, you feel like, oh, I felt a shake, I better tell everybody. But it's really useful data. Now, I'm not a geologist. I don't actually know what they use the data for. But the fact that there's this community of people doing citizen science reporting, all over the country is really powerful, I think.
And the Wellington Emergency Management did actually commission research to use an open source platform such that you could have an existing community of people who had signed up in that way, as if like having the GeoNet.
See, I didn't even know that. It's totally a phenomenal way to get people involved in science while also doing a public good.
Yes. Yeah, so before disaster strikes, you already have that network and people can pinpoint. Mm-hmm. And we talked about that after that sudden Auckland anniversary weekend flooding, where you had suddenly maybe official responses were a bit slow, and yet on social media you could see geolocated info coming in really quickly about how fast the water was rising. And I said, mm-hmm. look, if you have a bit of a network before that of people in certain places, verified locations, even right down to things where assets are, like tractors in a shed that could be used to, mm-hmm. Pull flooded vehicles out of gullies and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the interest, the big public interest in these sorts of projects suggests that there is sort of a latent interest in science in the community. And I think we absolutely should be tapping it in all sorts of ways, not just for basic research like what we do in our lab, but also for applied work like the parent-infant studies that we were talking about, but also for studies that are about, more pressing issues than just how we do music. Things like, diseases and social media stuff and like you say, emergency management. I mean, these are really big issues, and the fact that people are willing to participate in these sorts of lightly gamified tasks to be part of it is a big deal, I think.
Yep, citizen science can be fun. A bit of feedback here. Guy in Wellington says regarding the lullabies, perhaps saying I've missed the point that the lullabies help the parents relax and do something positive.
I think it's both. Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. I mean, when I sing a song to calm down my baby, I'm absolutely calmed as well. So I think it goes both ways. I mean, I think the health benefits of singing to young children are likely to be kind of cumulative in all directions, both in terms of time, so long-term cumulative, but also in terms of other people around. You know, a less stressed parent is going to have less stressed family members, not just the specific infant that they're trying to calm.
And just a quick fact check here from Jeff Wilson, Mount Albert. A bumper is on the front and the rear, fenders are on the side. Is he right about that?
Not sure how it goes interchangeable. I'll no comment for me because I can't say for sure.
Okay. And just really briefly, if we could, you have, I think, received a fellowship. So this is on behalf of Victoria, a Rutherford Fellowship on behalf of Victoria University.
The University of Auckland.
Oh, beg your pardon. So Psychological and Cultural Foundations of Music, another big study, or is that going to feed into what you're already doing?
So that's one of the grants that's funding our work here in Auckland. And there's also a Royal Society Marsden grant that's supporting our research here. We're supported partly by the Royal Society of New Zealand and partly by the National Institutes of Health in the U.S.
And do you need volunteers for this if you want to expand the citizen science? Do you want people to get in touch?
Absolutely. So people can visit the website at themusiclab.org. You can pick a game and play. If you're bored with our conversation at the moment, feel free to log right on. And we are going to be recruiting parents and infants for our new study of music and health, especially people who are living here in Aotearoa. You can sign up for that study at themusiclab.org/sign-up.
And that link is on our webpage to rnz.co.nz/Sunday. Thanks so much for joining us. Samuel Meir from the Music Lab and International Research Operation, zeroing in on how people all over the world really respond to music.